98 Interview.
Welcome back to the 98 Podcast, the home of everything in progressive and underground music right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and this week I'm not joined by Dave Ellis because we have another bonus interview episode. This week, Dave has been interviewing the man behind Melbourne-based prog project I Built the Sky, Rowan Stevenson. Rowan has been hard at work promoting the new record from I Built the Sky, The Zenith Rise. This chat covers the writing process, the process of hiring a new band to play with him on the road, ambitions, influences, and being an independent full-time musician here in Australia. Enjoy.
Last week at time of recording, I was fortunate enough to head along to see Galactic Empire. Now, for those of you who don't know who Galactic Empire are, chances are you probably saw them on your Facebook feed a little while ago, and they were doing a pretty rad cover of the Empire March, and it's a metal cover. Now, all the guys in the actual band are producers and or musicians in their own right. They're from the States, and they were absolutely fantastic. But I'll be really honest, the guys that I were there to see were the opening band Genetics, who I have postulated and spoken about quite a lot on this podcast, and the next act, which was I Built the Sky from Melbourne. To say that I Built the Sky absolutely wiped the floor with everybody else on the night is one hell of an understatement. And I am fortunate enough now to be joined here on the 98 podcast by the genius behind I Built the Sky. I Built the Sky, man. How are you, Ron?
Hey, how are you?
I am very well, very well. First and foremost, congratulations on an absolutely stellar performance and obviously being in two of the locations for what was a pretty nerdy but pretty damn awesome show.
Yeah, thank you.
It, by the way, Rowan's okay, yeah? People know that you're Rowan?
Yeah, Rowan's fine. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a gray area at the moment. I haven't really clarified, I guess, but it's only really in interviews that my actual name is really comes out, but
okay.
But the only reason being, it's just easier. Like, I just generally introduce myself as Ro. Ooh. So yeah.
Okay, Ro it is then. But, yeah. Now, Ro, you recently mentioned that you're now 100% in. With music. I think that was on the film clip for one of the tracks off your latest album. You mentioned that you'd quit your job and you were 100% in with music, and no matter what ended up happening with it, you knew you'd made the right choice. First and foremost, it takes a lot of balls to do that, so kudos. But how does it feel? And sort of moreover, where is the money coming from to back this? Because, I mean, whether we like it or whether we don't, money's kind of the second most important thing in the world, right up there with oxygen. So how do you afford to tour and do all the things that you want to do with I Built the Sky?
Great question. And it is nerve-wracking. You know, I'm not really stressing about it right now, but it is a situation that is I'm staring head on currently, I guess. But I do make money from music. I am independent, so I do make any income that comes in via streaming and Patreon and merch and CD sales and all that sort of thing. That does go to me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I have been investing in the past in that sort of thing and building up the name and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, so there's been a lot of pre-run-up and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But really, I'm kind of just going for it. And at the moment, everything's fine, but I've got to work hard to really get myself comfortable. I wouldn't say I'm comfortable yet.
Mm-hmm. And by comfortable, you mean sort of on an income level, or
yeah,
with
yeah, exactly.
How you're sitting, or
yeah, I mean, with the in regards to touring and stuff like that, like touring internationally, which is what's happening next year. Mm-hmm. Nothing announced yet, but there's gonna be some international action. But yeah, fuck, I don't know. I have to figure it out, you know. But that's what I'm gonna do.
Do you have any other sort of avenues of income? You know, do you ghost produce anything, or do you produce any tracks, or, you know, do you teach? Do you, you know, you mentioned that you're obviously 100% in with music, but obviously for some guys, for example, I know Scott from Voyager teaches on the side. I don't know about Simone, but I know Scott does. And I know a lot of other musos, particularly in Sydney, have, you know, a side gig where mostly it seems to be teaching. But some of them, you know, they run a studio, or they, you know, produce tracks, etc. I produce myself at home as well for, you know, pop and indie sort of stuff, which is a weird thing to think about when I'm a prog head, but anyway, do you have any kind of other income avenues like that, or you know, are you just 100% focused on getting I Built the Sky off the ground?
Well, yeah, primarily it's the streaming and Patreon and merchandising and YouTube, those avenues, and they're the ones that I want to build up primarily. But of course, I am gonna do like, I am going to offer like teaching from home. I'm not currently, but I will eventually, because I was working at it for a school, so I was teaching full time. So I kind of need a bit of a rest from it. But yeah, in my Patreon, I do actually offer teaching lessons as part of the tiers.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of it going on at the moment, but not my primary focus right now, but I think that's going to be something I can really push when, you know, next year when I'm trying to save up and all that sort of stuff, because it's a good way to make money, really, as a musician. Yeah, and I do enjoy it when I've had a bit of space from it, like, because I've been teaching like full on for the last like 7+ years.
Sure.
Yeah, so I was kind of burnt out a little bit there, but I think that's something I'm going to really get into next year as well, just teaching from home, teaching online. Apart from that, yeah, I do actually, I've got some inquiries about doing some mastering for a project and doing guest solos and that sort of thing. And I'll definitely be pushing to do like mixing jobs and, you know, even writing for people. All of the above, you know, anything to do with making music, that's what I want to pursue. So yeah, and also releasing new music, because that's going to be another part of streaming income, you know, YouTube stuff, all of that. So that's all the plan for the near future, I guess.
No, it's good. It's good to see you've got, you know, a semblance of a plan, because I do obviously speak to a lot of musos in and around the traps, and, you know, they just sort of do the, nah, man, I want to be a rock star. And it's like, okay, but how are you going to, you know, if the guys from Periphery, for example, they have to do all the other stuff that they do just to sort of make an income. You make being a rock star is not really on the cards anymore for people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough one.
Which is unfortunate, especially in Sydney. But, you know, speaking of musos and people that are dedicating time and such, your band that you played with the other night, incredible musos, absolutely incredible. I actually honestly thought there were 4 of you, and then it turned out there were 3, and you obviously play with some guitar backings and such as well, and it's quite easy to see why the stuff that you're playing isn't exactly friendly for people to learn. I'm not suggesting that people can't, but it is quite technical. You've assembled these incredible guys around you. Now, how much creative input do they have? Do they have any at all, or do you sort of write everything and give it to them and say, there you go, play? How's it work?
Well, so Jerome is a recent addition. Jerome plays drums for us currently. So he played his first show with us in Melbourne. We have had him as a fill-in prior to, but as the drummer of the band, his first show was in Melbourne for Galactic Empire's support. Sam has been playing with me for many years now, so he's the guy that actually does a lot of my videos and that sort of thing, so he's a very talented guy. As for creative input, I write the music, and I definitely get their input. I'll ask for, like, what do you think about this riff, or, you know, and sometimes, you know, they'll have ideas like, oh, why don't you try adding this kind of a thing here, or maybe, you know, maybe we should bring the chorus back here, that sort of thing. So ultimately I get the last decision. So
sure.
Which like it's just because like this is my project, you know? So I started as a soloist and sort of branched into the live aspect. But yeah, it's sort of my decision at the end, but I definitely get good ideas from Sam and previously Rob Brenz, who was playing prior to. Mm-hmm. Just yeah, little things like that. And Rob actually did a bit of programming the drums on the new album as well. So we did a bit of collabing on some of the programmed drums and different ideas there, and Rob brought in some cool ideas. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's pretty incredible. And you program all the drums yourself. You know, you sort of program them in yourself as well, or
yeah.
Do you sort of cheat a little bit and use a bit of MIDI here and then, you know, pre-made MIDI, I should say, and then tweak them? Or
nah, I never do that. I'll put in every single hit. I'll put in myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'll basically get the feel going. So what kind of groove I think would work well for the riff and the kick patterns and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then for the latest album, like I programmed everything on the album prior to, called The Sky Is Not the Limit.
Mm-hmm.
Which I just have so much fun doing. So yeah, it's just good fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't use pre-existing grooves or anything like that, because that's kind of not fun for me. I like to explore different drumming ideas and stuff like that.
Mm.
And then for this latest one, I basically sketched everything out, and then Rob would have a bit of a tweak of things and try different ideas over sections or interesting feels and stuff like that, and just bring that drummer perspective in. That was really cool.
Yeah, because I know personally when I've tried to write drum parts, generally speaking, I'm quite aware of whether or not the drummer has nine limbs, you know. But I think a lot of guitarists fall into that trap. You know, they go, oh, this sounds really good. And then a drummer picks it up and goes, you realize that's impossible, right?
Yeah.
You can't do that. So
yeah,
I think it's quite valuable, obviously, having a drummer at least look over what's being played. And then that album was taken, the latest album was taken, you actually recorded all that live, didn't you?
What's that?
The latest album, was that all recorded live, or was that all MIDI drums sort of with software and all that
stuff? Yeah, so the drums on that are programmed.
Yep. Seriously?
Yeah.
Shit. Okay.
Yep.
Righto. Yep. No, that's what I've got to nerd out a little bit here. What are you using? What's the program?
So what you're hearing on the album, I don't know what the program is being used there.
Right.
Because Forrester is the guy who mixed it, so he's got...
So that'll be Superior Drummer then, for sure.
Well, I think it's not. I think it's like... I suspect it's Get Good Drums, maybe.
Yeah, good point.
Or something else, but I'm not entirely sure. But he does actually... He did a... he made his own drum sounds, and they released it as called a Progressive Foundry, I believe.
Yes, for Toon Track, yeah.
Yeah, so I've used some of those drum sounds before on things, but I don't actually know what he used on the album. So I'm actually, I'm interested to know myself.
Yeah. Should fire him an email and be like, which fake drums did you use? I shouldn't call them fake drums, because they are actually sampled and they sound amazing. Obviously, they fooled me, so
yeah.
That's pretty good. So when it does come to your writing process, you sort of, do you lock yourself in a room and sort of stare at your guitar for a little bit? You know, do you start with drums? Do you start with bass? Where do you start? How does it sort of all come about?
Yeah, usually I'll have like a drum loop, some sort of drum loop, and I'll play along with that. So the drum loop sort of just helps set up the vibe and all that sort of thing. And then I'll just basically hype myself up, and like, you know, it's a really fun experience for me. Like, I really enjoy it. So I'm generally hyped up and just trying to like explore, you know, the guitar and figure out interesting choices for notes or riffs or rhythms, and play along to the drums. And then if I get a more specific riff happening, eventually I'll really feel certain accents, and then I'll evolve the drums around that too, and start to shape it that way. And then I'll start to add like layers underneath. I think that's a really significant part of my music, is like the layers underneath, which aren't very obvious, but they sort of, they help with like forward momentum and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the underneath layers are usually very simple and very, very just, they're just very straight sort of rhythmically. And mm-hmm. that way I can, you know, you as a listener, you sort of, you feel that pulse, even though there's weird accents and things happening. The pulse is there via those layers and via the cymbals and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so then I just keep kind of dialing it in, and then before long I'll have like a section of, you know, a riff or something like that, and then I'll try and get to the next section happening. So I kind of feel like it's almost like a video game, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get to the next section, and then when I listen back, I'm like listening to see if it feels right to me, like hearing from one section to another. Mm-hmm. And you know, I might, something not quite right about it, so I'll go back and tweak it, or tweak how the next section comes in or something, you know, just keep sort of manipulating things. And you know, I feel like a lot of the times I kind of black out, you know, and I'm just going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'll come back the next day and push play and I'll be like, oh shit, you know, half a song there.
Oh god, now I have to relearn it.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're anything like me anyway. So then obviously you put your layers on and you sort of, you know, work it from there, put your bass in, etc.
Yeah.
You play all the instruments, don't you?
Yeah. Well, it's really guitar and bass, I guess. Everything else programmed.
Yeah.
I did some singing on this one too.
Yeah, well, I was going to say there's a couple of other little instruments and such, because you've got some synth stuff in there as well, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that's all programmed in whatever the program is. I assume you use Pro Tools like nearly everybody else does these days.
Yeah, Pro Tools, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, no, it is interesting because everyone has such a different way of writing. I think you and I are a little bit similar in that I'll find a drum beat that I really like and then go, oh, cool, I can hear something over the top of that, and then sort of play something, you know, over the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I'm certainly not on your level, so it's a little bit different. Now your latest album, The Zenith Rise, cool title, by the way. Thank Great you. Title. Having played the album live now, you've played it, you know, for the last little while anyway.
We've only actually played one song off the new album so far, so we're still waiting to get the rest of the tracks up and running, actually, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was, you know what? This question then can wait for next time.
Okay.
Because it's it's kind of irrelevant. But having finished the album, and now the fact that you've finished it and you've got it in sort of in your hands and you're listening to it, is there anything that you would have done differently? Would have you added in an extra track or taken away any, or, you know, changed a solo bit?
Of course. Yeah, definitely. Lots of things I would change for sure, but like I don't really want to say what specifically, but there's things that I would change. And I think, I say that now, but I think, you know, in 2 years' time, I won't think like that. You know, I think it's a very normal thing to think of, you know, when you just release something, you think, oh, I should have done this or should have done that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, I'm very happy with it. Like, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I think that's just the feeling that a lot of artists get, you know, you're never quite finished. It's only abandoned.
Yeah. Yeah. I was about to say, I think that's a trap that a lot of artists can fall into, is they sort of do the redux and then they tweak it some more and tweak it some more and tweak it some more and tweak it some more until, you know, they're almost sick of hearing it. And then it becomes almost like a bad song because you kind of get sick of listening to the same thing over and over again.
Or you take it too far and you make bad choices, and really it was good before, you know?
Which absolutely happens. So that album, Zenith Rise, you have had, to put it lightly, you've had a little bit of success with that one. You've had some chart success with it as well. From what I understand, you've charted in a few little places.
Yeah.
I think you were number 8 on Bandcamp in the metal genre, number 13 on the Australian Independent Albums, number 28 iTunes Australia rock charts, and number 50 on iTunes Australia overall, and of course number 1 from your mum. I mean, that must be pretty awesome to see those. Yeah, a couple of them are sort of very much Australian orientated, but number 8 Bandcamp, I mean, that's a global audience.
Yeah.
How's it feel to get that sort of accolade?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah. I don't know what to say. It's exciting. Yeah. I feel very lucky, you know. I don't know. It's cool. It's a great feeling.
No, it's certainly you deserve it. Let me put it that way. You certainly deserve it because you've worked obviously extremely hard. You don't get the musical ability that you do without, you know, putting a lot of hard yakka in with all of that. But let's change gears a little bit real quick and talk about influences.
Yep.
Who is your main influence? So if someone was to come up to you and say, "Hey, man, who would be the one guy that I should listen to try and learn everything that you've learned?"
Wow. It's a really hard question to answer. I don't really feel like there's one specific artist. But maybe I could list two for you right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess like early on, like Periphery and like Misha Mansour, as he sort of was the guy that made me planted the idea in your head, in my head, that you can make your own music and, you know, produce it yourself and, you know, have good results that way and program drums and that sort of thing. So that got me really excited about that, being able to do something on my own. And like that crossed with like Foo Fighters mentality, you know, if like songs really, really and just like fun vibe songs. So I kind of feel like that's two influences that are pretty strong in my music. Like I guess older Foo Fighters, really grunge driven rock songs, but with the technicality of, you know, Misha and Periphery kind of thing. That's my personal ideas, but other people might not see that or feel differently, but yeah.
No, it's an interesting mix, because normally you wouldn't sort of associate, you know, a very large rock band, i.e., or hard rock band, I should say, you know, i.e. the Fooies, with people who necessarily listen to that sort of proggy style of things. Not that people are, I mean, let's be honest, but there's a lot of metal snobs out there, but they're not, you know, necessarily exclusive. But melding those two is something that's obviously it's worked very well for you.
Yeah, I wonder if people feel that too or not. But yeah, like my whole background has been, you know, coming up from the punk sort of vibe. You know, I'm big, you know, big Blink-182 fan and that sort of thing, where it's very much about the songs, or not about the who can out shred who, but I do enjoy, you know, going pretty hard on technical aspects of guitar playing, because I enjoy that. So I try to marry the two. Where some people can fall into the trap of it just sounds like amazing shredding over backing tracks, which is what I just do not enjoy that at all. Like, like, you know, a lot of really amazing guitar players don't do it for me because of that reason. They are absolutely phenomenal guitar players, but I don't really want to listen to their music because there's no like emotive like songs in it. It's just in incredible playing over what just feels like a backing track to me. So that's something I avoid at all costs. So I really, I really try to make the song as the forefront or the focus rather than the techniques.
Interesting. I think it's also something to be marveled at as well, because it's anyone can play at speed and, you know, shred. There's better shredders out there than others, obviously, but, you know, playing at speed with no feeling is very different to doing, very highly emotive things. And I think it's certainly nothing to be sniffed at, that's for sure. How about things which influence you not in the musical sphere? You know, what I'm asking is, what are your guilty pleasures?
Okay. Guilty pleasures. I mean, I guess being a little bit lazy, I definitely enjoy vegging out and just like watching random YouTube stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes they plant seeds in your head about an idea or maybe like a video concept that you might pursue.
For sure.
Like for example, urban exploring, mm-hmm. which is the big culture out there of people that go to, you know, abandoned areas and explore around and that sort of thing. It's really interesting to see. The videos people upload, it's pretty interesting. Like, buildings and things that have been abandoned for many years, and you go in there and it's like people just up and left, and you know, there's things still as they were 10 years later and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
I think is pretty much what inspired us to go to this place to do the last video we did for a song called Light Pillars.
Mm-hmm.
We found this abandoned like factory.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was really interesting to film in there, because it was like kind of creepy and a massive factory that was completely empty and sort of worn down, and lots of like artists go in there and make, you know, spray paint art and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool. So I guess that stuff sort of seeps in here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But as in musically guilty pleasures or?
Oh, just guilty pleasures in general. I wasn't asking specifically due to music. I find it interesting that you mentioned the thing about the YouTube, you know, sort of having a stumble, as it used to be called back in the day, I suppose. Because one of my big guilty pleasures, for example, is Gordon Ramsay, right? I absolutely love watching everything and anything to do with Gordon Ramsay.
Oh, yeah,
awesome. Being a bit of a cook, having a bit of a culinary backbone as well myself. I agree with you. There is stuff that sometimes happens, you know, you can just look at a video on the way it's put together, and you sort of look at it and go, actually, that's a really cool way that they've cut that. Maybe I can use that in a video clip or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There's just so much amazing stuff on YouTube that can be super inspiring. Mm. Even just like, you know, motivational videos are really cool too, I think. Like sometimes you struggle with motivation and stuff. I do personally, you know, but sometimes there's like videos people make and it really gets you going, you know, so.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. I love YouTube.
Yeah, it's come a long way since its dating days, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So obviously I opened this little interview talking about the Galactic Empire gigs. I think it'd be a bit remiss of us not to talk about those. Yep. You were with them for two shows, one in Melbourne and one in Sydney.
Yep.
How was it? How was the reception?
Great. Really good. I think I was having some technical issues in Melbourne,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't too bad, but it just, that kind of thing really, like, it's frustrating, you know, when you're performing and you know it's just something out of your control is kind of dampening the end result of your performance. So that kind of got to me a little bit, but,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, it's always, I feel like we get a really, really insane response, and sometimes really like surprising sometimes, like, because like you never know how you're going to be, you know, taken to, especially like Galactic Empire is quite like, I guess it's I guess it's in the same category, but yeah, it's just hard to know what their fans are going to think of a band like us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's always really like surprising. I guess, I don't know if it's surprising, but I'm definitely stoked when someone comes up after the show and, you know, wants to buy our CDs and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm pleasantly surprised, I'll say that.
Mm-hmm. And how was it so far as, you know, financially is concerned? I'm not asking you to pull out a spreadsheet, but, you know, was the reception positive enough for you guys to make a bit of dosh on the side?
Well, because of the costs associated, basically I came out about even.
Okay.
Which is like paying the guys in the band, you know, for their efforts and, you know, the travel and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would have come out about even.
Okay.
But, like, it's part of, it's to be expected initially, you know. You got to sort of be aware that, you know, you're going to have to invest, like, it takes, you know, many years to really get yourself to a point where it is very profitable in the live aspect. Like, if you're playing internationally, you're expecting to lose money, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you're spreading the word and it's gonna build you up later on. So it's worth doing. And I definitely feel like there's gonna be a lot more investing to come before I really start to see the other side of you know, financially, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for me, because it's like my project and I'm paying everyone's expenses and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it that little bit harder, I guess.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it is a, for wanted use of a better term, it's a business, isn't it? And I mean,
absolutely.
Most businesses have got a startup period of 4 or 5 years anyway. So, you know, and they're basically losing money for that first 4 or 5 years. So it's not really any different in the music industry, is it?
No, it's a hard one really, because, you know, you in a way, you know, I guess it's the wrong word, but like, I guess I'm competing with hobbyists as well, you know, so that's where it's a difficult road to take, but it's the one I'm choosing to take and the one I want to take either way. You know, it's not just, see, that's the thing. I mean, sometimes live is not a profitable thing for me, but but you know, when I release albums, I'm the money comes back to me for streaming, and that's basically one of the bigger streams for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, it's possible that I just get to a point where I just can't perform, you know, because it's just not viable enough for me to be able to do it, mm-hmm. or I can't like do international things. Like let's say things don't amplify like I'm, you know, trying to push for, then that's just, you know, that's just the reality. I'll just have to stick to local based shows or be very selective of my shows.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't think I'm really going to be working hard to build it up so that, you know, it's only going to become more profitable and more profitable. So I'm not worried about that, but that's just what you'd have to do, say, if it wasn't where you need it to be able to continue. So I mean, yeah, that aspect of it is a difficult thing initially, like the live part of things, especially with the traveling expenses, living expenses, and you know, paying your home expenses while you're away. It's a challenging thing, but that's part of the process. And you know, when you push through that and you get to the next level and you start coming back even, and then you start profiting on top and that sort of thing. I think actually nationally, I think will be a lot more profitable for me, because if I'm supporting another band, you only get a set fee, and that's usually quite low.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, I'm not complaining or anything like that, but that's just how it is.
Yeah.
When you run your own shows, you're gonna make a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing to take into account.
And I mean, I suppose that when you're sort of paying for a lot of things off your own back, you are sort of thinking about how to economize a little bit. So, I mean, I noticed that you basically used one guitar the entire night. I don't know. Do you gig with a backup? Do you gig? You travel reasonably light, I presume.
Yeah, we travel as light as possible. I actually did have a backup guitar. I just didn't need it. So, yeah, I'll always travel with at least two guitars. But yeah, exactly. That's the thing. When I was employed, I could it wouldn't worry me if I, you know, stay in an Airbnb and stuff like that or whatever it is. But yeah, now it's just we got to think about things carefully and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's a lot more to navigate and that. But yeah, I'm more than happy to engage in that.
I do want to say here as well that I know that you stayed in Sydney. You actually stayed with a fan that was willing to put his house up for yourself, the band, and the sound guy. Yeah. I do want to say on here that for all the listeners that are listening, if you have a favorite band that is coming to Sydney or to wherever it is that you are living, get in touch with them and ask them whether or not they do have a place to stay, especially if you're sort of a little bit known around the circles and you're sort of a trustworthy chap and you're not likely to, you know, knock off their instruments, because I'll guarantee you that they really would appreciate the place to stay. It is a big cost. Having toured myself, and I'm sure you can back me up on this, Ro, you're talking, particularly in Sydney, you know, a hotel room for the night's $400. And when you're not making that much from ticket sales and so on and so forth, that's a big cost. Is that generally, when you have toured in the past, have you stayed in mostly in Airbnbs or hotels? You know, have you relied on the goodwill of fans and people around, or?
Well, yeah, previously, because I was employed, I wasn't worried about that, and I was happy to do Airbnb options and stuff like that. So we didn't generally do that. A couple of times we stayed at people's houses and things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a kind of a tricky one, really, because you don't want to, you know, I don't generally feel too good about putting someone out in that way, you know? If you've got four people with you, it's a lot of people to have over. So I generally have tried to avoid that, really, but it's something that I'm gonna have to fully embrace just because it's just, I mean, that's all the difference between, like I said, I came back basically even. If I had to pay $400 for accommodation for the night, well, there you go. I'd be down $400. So I've got to be exploring these options. Yeah, it's just the realities of my life, I guess.
And out of curiosity, what did you do beforehand?
I teached at a school, taught.
Okay, so it was just the teaching role. That's what you quit.
Yeah, I was teaching music. I was teaching instrumental guitar and keyboard, right. Mostly keyboard.
Right, there you go. Mm. So you're a pianist by trade?
I'd say no.
Okay.
But I guess I was.
Okay.
If someone was to offer me a piano gig, I would be like, I'd probably laugh.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. But I, because I was, you know, I was doing primary school kids and that sort of thing. Not really, it's well within my means, I guess.
Mm. In the words of Marge Simpson, you just have to stay one lesson ahead, right?
Well, you know, not really, because then you can't like answer questions, but.
For sure.
I was more than comfortable what I was doing. No issues there. But I did actually learn piano, and I did like AMEB up to grade 6.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, I'd say if I, you know, had a gun to my head, I could probably whip something up, you know, if I needed to perform or whatever. I could probably just scrape by, I guess, but I wouldn't call myself a piano player or anything like that.
There you go. The more you know, the more you learn. Let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about gear. So I know for a time you were playing PRS. Now you're playing Carvin, is that correct?
Kiesel, yeah.
Sorry, Kiesel. Kiesel. Apologies. You're playing Kiesel guitars. Yeah. How did that come about? How did the relationship there with the Kiesel brand come about?
We actually met them at NAMM, which was 2017. And we got recognized because me and Sam went over there.
Mm-hmm.
We were going into different guitar booths and stuff like that, having a bit of a look around, seeing what's happening. Kiesel have a really impressive booth every year,
mm-hmm.
Like a big booth, and you know, lots of really cool stuff. And they're really at the forefront of guitar technology. They do things like adding 2 carbon fiber rods in every single neck.
Mm-hmm.
They do things like stainless steel frets in every single guitar,
mm-hmm.
Lumen lace side dots in every single guitar. So you buy the cheapest guitar, you're going to get those 3 elements, those, you know, really premium elements in your guitar. But yeah, they're always innovating things and doing really, really amazing, you know, wood selections and different finishes and that sort of thing. And so, you know, that obviously caught our eye. So I wanted to go and have a look there. And one of the guys that works for Kiesel actually recognized us because he was playing in a band that we supported in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
His band at the time was called Chon.
Yep.
And yeah, so it was one of those really freaky situations where we got recognized in the booth, and he straight away was like, "Oh, you should, you know, come over to us, check out our guitars." And yeah, we mm-hmm. ended up hitting it off and had a good play of their guitars and thought I'd make the switch.
Hmm. And obviously happy that you did.
Absolutely, because the support they've given us has been huge.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Sam actually got his 2 basses stolen,
mm-hmm.
and they actually sent us over a bass, you know.
Jeez.
To help us out. And, you know, they do a lot of promoting music videos and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really great relationship. So it's been amazing. And I've got like 5 Kiesel guitars now, and I've bought a new one actually. So I got another one coming along,
mm-hmm.
and I love them. They're great. They mm-hmm. sound amazing, feel great. They're just really great for touring with and recording.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, love them.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. And I would get murdered by the other guitarists that actually listen to this podcast if I didn't ask you, what strings do you use?
Strings, yeah. So I use D'Addario NYXL.
Yep.
And I use the gauge that's 11 to 52. So,
and you're in, what tuning are you in? You're in drop C?
Yeah, drop C.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's C, G, C, F, A, D, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah, so I actually use kind of lighter strings than a lot of people I know of in the same sort of style. But I'm a kind of a light player, so I'm pretty light with my fingers, I think. And it just works for me. I think it's a great set for what I do.
And you're obviously running an AX8 on the board there. All your own presets and amp sounds and everything in that?
Yeah, yep. I love tweaking those sounds and things.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one that I use predominantly is called Daz Metal, I think it's called,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think it's a diesel.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a VH4 clone, I think, from memory.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but yeah, you can get some pretty insane sounds out of them.
Absolutely. I had one of the first Axe FX's that were released, the Mark I, when it came out, and it was absolutely amazing. And then I sold it and went back to amps, and then I went back to bias, and yeah, wow. it's a never ending cycle.
was that previous to the Ultra, was it?
Yeah, the Axe FX, just the straight up Axe FX.
Wow. Probably rare as now.
I don't think they were super rare. You could get them here. I bought it from the States, but it just used to sit underneath my monitor and used to do things and blah blah blah. And then the Ultra came out, and then the two Ultra, I think, and it was just I went back to using my amps and
yep.
Yeah, just stopped worrying about it so much. Now, you did mention a little bit earlier, obviously with all that lightweight gear, you're going to be doing some traveling internationally soon. You said nothing's locked in yet, so I'm not going to make you reveal anything on the podcast. But do you have any future tour plans for Australia, say in the next 6 months, or is it mostly all overseas stuff?
Yes, Australia's going to be in the next 6 months for sure. So okay. we're just kind of starting to get that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But I would predict around April, May.
Okay.
Yeah, so I want to do, I'd love to hit every city, you know, but it's just that's the thing is I've got to be very clever with my choices in that sort of thing. So
yeah,
like things like Perth is a pretty hard one to make viable.
Yes.
But I have been to, we have played Perth twice before and it's been nothing but an amazing experience. So mm-hmm. I'll definitely be pushing for it. But yeah, it's just one of those things. You have to do all the boring bigger work and figure out if it's going to be a viable option to take. Mm-hmm. There is a Hobart gig booked.
Ooh, okay.
But I can't reveal when yet, but that's happening.
No, that's not a problem. Like I said, not going to make you reveal anything that you're not, especially nothing that you're not comfortable with revealing anyway.
Well, I'm going to say there's a festival based in UK booked as well. But
beautiful.
All will be revealed in time.
Mm, absolutely. Well, we wish you Godspeed for all of that. Now, obviously, safe travels and everything that's coming up immediately. But you know, the busy life of a musician is like is sometimes you just don't get to talk to people for a while. So,
sure.
But yeah, definitely. All the best for all of those. And I might get onto Hoggy as well and see whether or not he'd be willing to put you guys up when you guys go over to Perth because.
Oh wow!
The aforementioned tour costs, the economics of touring is never easy in a continent the size of ours.
Yeah.
So look, we're sort of coming to the end here. Two sort of final questions we always do like to end on.
Yep.
The first one is something that we do on the 9-8 podcast where myself and Hoggy, we give each other an album to review every week. And it can be absolutely any album in the world. It doesn't matter. But obviously there's the benefit there as well for our listeners as well, who might hear something that they like, or, you know, maybe they'll hear something they'll never like again. And then as a result, everything else will sound better. So what's the one album that you would recommend to me and to our listeners, to have a listen to?
I would say Sunk Lotto, Between Birth and Death.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Probably my all-time favorite metal album.
Okay. Right. Sunk Lotto, Between Birth and Death.
Yeah.
Righto. Beautiful. I'll put that one in the show notes as well. And by the way, listeners, anything that has been mentioned here on this today, you can find all the links in the show notes below as per usual. Now, your stuff is available online, obviously, in all the usual streaming places, but you do have a Bandcamp. And yep. Frankly, I think people need to go out and buy your album because a stream for, you know, half of a cent is just ridiculous. So what is the Bandcamp? Where can we find it?
Well, if you just type in ibuiltthesky.com, it'll link you straight to the Bandcamp. So that's probably the easiest way to do it.
How easy is that?
Yeah.
And you've got all your stuff on there, some merch, I believe, on there as well.
Yeah, you can get T-shirts and the CD. Unfortunately, no more vinyls because they're all sold out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there is some CDs available.
Mm-hmm.
And they've come out amazing, really cool, especially the actual disc, really, really well put together. Had a good help with a guy named Pat Fox doing the artwork and that sort of thing.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Well, look, thank you so much, Ro, for joining us on the 9-8 podcast. It was absolute pleasure, as I mentioned, to see you the other day and see you guys play and tear the stage up because that's exactly what you did. You must have noticed that in the audience you had some other pretty big music royalty, sort of from the metal scene anyway, in Sydney there. Most of the guys from Polaris were there. I saw James Norbertivani as well. He was there. Yep. Matt from Code Atlantic was there as well. I think one of the guys from Memory from Halcyon Rain was there as well, which was amazing. So you got reasonably good turnout. It would have been nicer if it was a little bit more full for you guys, but that's just the way Sydney goes, unfortunately.
Yeah, nah,
sometimes.
Sure. Nah, we had a great experience. I really loved our show in Sydney. I had a good time. Felt pretty good about it. Fun fact.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan, he actually packed up my gear for me.
Oh, there you go.
So there you go.
Yeah, that's lovely.
So really random, but just shows he's an awesome dude.
Yeah, and I was about to say, it's always good when musos are sort of all in it together. And I think if there's one thing that people need to take away from the music industry, it is that we are all in it together, whether that's us muso journos sitting on this side in musos, or musos themselves, or producers, etc. We're all sort of in the fight together. So. Yeah, so look, Ro, thank you so much for spending the time with us here today. Brand new album from I Built the Sky, The Zenith Rise, available on all streaming platforms and also on their Bandcamp website, which you can access by going to ibuiltthesky.com. Ro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The 9/8 interview.